Well, thank you very much for having me. I think without further ado, let's get into it. So yeah, first of all, just to list my collaborators real fast. This is primarily based on these two papers. First, a paper by myself and my advisor, Taylor Hughes, and then this kind of spiritual successor follow-up paper, which was myself, Taylor, as well as two graduate student collaborators of mine, Mark Hirschbrunner and Chuchin Chow. Yeah, so to begin with, what are we going to focus on this talk? Well, the real thing I'm going to try to get into is how we understand the responses of topological phases to lattice defects. And really, when you're thinking about topological defects, I'm going to be talking about responses to fluxes of C in rotation symmetry. Now, we're going over this in more detail so we can really get a good understanding for how these two defect and rotation flux languages are, in fact, the same. And my hope is that we can understand that, show you that one, the response of lattice fermions to the disclination defects can actually be understood very well by considering continuum theories of fermions in curved space, and that this one correctly described responses of these higher order topological insulator phases, which I'll also be going into more and more detail later on. And actually, more interestingly, we can use this idea of this mapping between fermion-disclinated lattices and fermions in curved space to actually predict new responses that we can, in fact, realize in lattice models. So to begin with, I'm going to go over a bit of how we understand symmetry fluxes in topological phases. And you know, we all have a big question for any talk like this. So my big question here is, how do we understand topological phases of matter? Like, what is the essential ingredient here? And you know, there's had a long history. We have invariants, we have anomalies, which we heard a lot about at the most recent workshop. There's a lot of different angles to how we understand this question. I'm going to be presenting one, which is going to be very focused on the responses of these systems to external probes. That's kind of going to be my angle of this. I think it's a very powerful method. For one, it allows us to understand the more physical aspects of these systems. And on top of that, it actually does allow us to infer things about their anomaly structure as well, although maybe not as powerful as the direct anomaly language like we've heard about from some of the other speakers over this week. And I'll just give you some definitions and set a little more context. I'm going to be talking entirely about fermionic symmetry-protected systems, or SPTs, that are not interacting, so basically just band insulators for the time being, although I will discuss a bit about future directions for non-band insulators later on. And some examples of this are going to be your energy quantum Hall state, your SSH chain, or Shoestriger-Heger chain, as well as various topological insulating phases in both two dimensions and three dimensions. And just to have like a good precise definition of SPT out of the way as well, we're going to be talking about gap phases of matter that cannot be deformed into a trivial insulator, so one particle per site, nothing special going on, without option A breaking the symmetry or option B closing the gap. Just kind of everyone go to the definitions. Any questions here before I go on? All right, good. Yeah, so as I alluded to before, a lot of these SPTs can be understood by how they respond to symmetry fluxes. So just kind of what are the symmetry flux? I'll just get a good definition in mind. So we have some sort of symmetry G that has an element, little g, and some sort of representation of that element, which I'm going to call U of G. Now we have some sort of G flux, and I'm going to label this way. I'll just say a two-dimensional system where the flux is the x, if you imagine on a 2D sheet. And take some sort of object, which is going to be this blue circle. And I'm going to take that around my flux. When I find that when I get back to my initial starting point, I find I've now acted on that object with my symmetry representation U of G. And so this is really the holonomy around the flux is going to be the symmetry action. It's a more mathematically precise way of talking about this. But really, we're assigning holonomies, sorry, symmetry actions to holonomies is really the way of thinking about it here. And the most famous example is going to be how we understand the quantum Hall insulators in terms of their responses to fluxes of U1 symmetry. So here, the symmetry action would be some sort of phase rotation. As we take our electron around this flux, it's going to pick up a U1 phase. So the basic idea of how we go about this is we use the fact that quantum Hall insulators have a quantized Hall conductance, and then we're going to use Laughlin's pumping argument to show that now charge is bound to magnetic fluxes, and that's really the characterizing response of these quantum Hall insulators in a certain sense. So the classic experiment we have is the Corbino disk. We have a flux that's time-dependent going through the center of this. That's going to drive an electric field shown with this. That's not showing up. Interesting. Can you guys, am I going crazy or can I not see this on the board?
No, yeah, I doesn't.
Okay, well then, oh man, willing to hockey stick after all. But yeah, so actually I'm just gonna have this on standby in case I need it later. But anyways, the basic idea is that we have this, you know, electric field here, which is gonna be circulating due to the inserting of flux, and it's gonna drive a current due to the Hall conductance. So as the flux increases, charge is gonna flow from the outer boundary to the inner boundary of our system, which is going to lead to an accumulation of charge at this inner radius. And that means, and also now if we attend to use the fact that now since flux insertion is a periodic process, the fermions only feel the phase of the flux mod 2 pi, we know that as we insert a total of 2 pi flux, whatever is going to be pumped from one boundary to the other boundary has to be an integer amount of charge. And basically, this integer amount of charge is going to be exactly our churn number of our system. This goes a very natural way of going from basically responses to symmetry fluxes, and we now have a churn number. So this is kind of one way we can use the symmetry fluxes to basically very easily understand the key properties of topological systems. Any questions here before I go on? We have fractional quasi-particles then, which is, you know, the famous, you know, that's why how we know we have fractional quasi-particles from a fractional Hall conductance is that we see that the total amount of charge we get after a 2 pi flux is actually some fractional amount, which means there's some sort of local, and I'm going to put that in quotes, excitation that carries a fractional amount of charge. Although I'm sure you already know that. okay, so let's do some other examples to kind of show you this is not just like a one and done type thing. Let's do some, let's do a 2D topological insulator, aka a quantum spin Hall. Here we're going to look at the specific case where this has both U1 charge and a conserved SZ component of spin. And it turns out that this is going to realize a mixed response. We're going to find that charge is going to bind spin. And so the basic idea is that we have for these systems a spin Hall conductance, where basically if we insert a charge flux, so a U1 charge flux through that center, we're going to drive an electric field. That electric field is not going to drive a charge current, it's going to drive a spin current, which it looks like basically up spin's going one way, down spin's going the other way. This again leads to an accumulation of spin on the inner ring. And so again, by the same argument, we can define, say, a spin churn number, which will be the amount of spin you accumulate as you insert a 2 pi flux. There's also the inverse. We can imagine now we have a spin flux, which is going to be some sort of flux that feels positive to spin up fermions, negative spin down fermions. And that, by the same logic, is going to drive a charge current, which will lead to a charge accumulation around the spin flux. The more interesting case, now we go to 3D. We now have three-dimensional TIs, or axion insulators. This has what's known as a quantized magnetoelectric effect. And just to kind of go over and I think some more terse details what happens here, we have, for example, the Witten effect, where we have that a magnetic monopole carries some amount of charge. Here for these fermionic topological insulators, that's a charge 1/2 assigned to our magnetic monopoles. And additionally, if I break symmetry on my surface of my TI, or just have a gap surface of my axion insulator, we find that that surface is going to have a half integer Hall conductance. So again, by the similar kind of Laplacian pumping argument, we can also interpret this half integer Hall conductance as some sort of a response to fluxes. All right, everyone good with this? All right. So it all turns out there's a very beautiful way of expressing these responses in terms of topological field theories with quantized coefficients. Very famously, we have that the two-dimensional quantized Hall conductance corresponds to the Chern-Simons term, where the integer C out front is quantized by gauge symmetry. And here, just kind of let you know what we're talking about. A is always going to be a U1 charge gauge field. And everywhere in this talk, if you see a gauge field of any kind, it's a background probe, not dynamic. If you're thinking dynamics, you're doing something wrong in this talk. These are all purely probe gauge fields. I know there is, technically it's imprecise to call a probe field a gauge field, but I hope you can forgive that abusive language on my behalf. Yes, and then if we, so we can use this now, response Lagrangian, to find out we have one, our Hall conductance, which tells us that current is going to be equal to the perpendicular electric field. And we have, again, our characteristic response that charge is bound to magnetic fluxes. And similarly, if we go to this three-dimensional TIs that have this magnetoelectric effect, we have this term right here. Theta is now going to be quantized by either time reversal symmetry or inversion symmetry, depending if we're looking at a topological insulator or an axion insulator, respectively. And if I take my functional derivative, I then find that charge is going to be down to magnetic monopoles, exactly the Witten effect I saw before. And you can, like, say, look at domain walls in phi, sorry, theta, excuse me, to find this half quantized Hall conductance as well. So we can see we can really express a lot of these features I've gone over in more abstract terms in a very literal way through these topological field theories. And these also tell us a lot about the anomaly structure. For example, we can use the Chern-Simons term to know about the chiral anomaly, the surface of a quantized Hall conductor. And we can also use this, you know, theta term in the 3D magnetoelectric effect to find out about our surface Hall conductance, which is 1/2. All right. And so on a little more of a microscopic level, we can always write down these things by just knowing the responses based on more phenomenology. Say we know what our system does. But we can do it on a much more literal level by actually taking our microscopic theory of thermions, coupling it to our U1 gauge field as a probe, and then integrating out our microscopic degrees of freedom to arrive at our effective Lagrangian, which is just going to be the log of our partition function. Typically, it takes the form of some sort of loop expansion or some sort of perturbative expansion. And the saving grace of these things most times is that you only have to do maybe one loop diagram because these coefficients are quantized either by gauge invariance or by an external symmetry. And so typically, you only have to do a one loop calculation, find the coefficient, then you can argue from that and quantization of the coefficient. You don't need to look at subleading terms as well. All right, I think that takes me back to the end of my overview. Any questions there before I move on to, I would say, the more meat and potatoes of this work? All right, great, it's my crowd. All right, so it turns out that we have a topological phase of a lattice system. These can also host quantized responses to fluxes of lattice symmetry. And by lattice symmetry, I mean CN rotation, discrete translation, or mirror symmetry. And for this talk, I'm really going to be focusing almost entirely on CN rotation symmetry. I'll be touching on translation a little bit towards the end, but really CN rotation is going to be the big one throughout. So fluxes of lattice symmetry physically correspond to lattice defects. And I'll be discussing this more in detail in the context of disclinations going forward. But basically, we have that translation flux is going to be our dislocation, which has a sort of Burgers vector, which corresponds to how much you translate as you go around this defect. And similarly, we have that our disclination is going to be a rotation symmetry flux characterized by a Frank angle, where if we go around this, it's rotated by some amount, which is a Frank angle. And for an example of the responses you might have associated with these symmetry fluxes, one which is going to be the main point of this talk is going to be the fact that you can have charge bound to these defects. Or equivalently, we can see that charge will be bound to symmetry fluxes of rotation symmetry. And this should be thought of, at least what I'm going to propose, that we can think about this in a very analogous way to the way that charge is bound to magnetic symmetry fluxes in a quantum Hall insulator. And in a very, very literal way we can do this, I'll be discussing later on, but that's kind of the rough intuition I want you guys to have going into this. All right. So let's talk more about disclination defects and really get the language we're going to need to go further in this. So in two dimensions, this is what disclination looks like. Basically, I have a triangle made out of squares with some sort of defect. I have a triangle in the middle or maybe some point where three vertices intersect with each other. And in practice, this basically comes about when you take a lattice, you cut out a little quadrant as shown here, and then glue it back together with some sort of a pyrals factor, which is dictated by rotation symmetry. And there's basically a very manifest way to do this. If I know how my rotation symmetries act on my lattice, I can always figure out the unique way of gluing this back together, such as I have the correct disclination defect. And basically, this cut I'm showing here essentially becomes invisible from the point of view of the fermions. I can only define basically a local unitary, such as I can move basically the cut to any point I want to and kind of always move it away from the interesting stuff, if I want to say that way. So in two dimensions, we have that these disclinations are point-like objects, the same way magnetic fluxes are point-like in two dimensions. And similarly, if we're in three dimensions, our flux disclinations are going to be line defects. Same way, again, that magnetic fluxes are line-like in three dimensions. So a little bit more precisely, if I take an object V that transforms into some sort of representation of Cn, I'm going to find that when I parallel transport this object around my disclination, I'm going to rotate V. And so for a very precise example, I'll start with a vector, this vector 1 labeled in red right here. And as I take this around my defect, like this to 2, to 3, and then back to 4, I find that during that parallel process, I've now rotated my vector by pi over 2. And again, to get the language a little more precise, these disclinations are characterized by a Frank angle, which is going to be a number in 2D or a vector in 3 dimensions. And that's going to be equal to the amount that the lattice vector is going to be rotated around a disclination. I might just use the phrase loosely that how much it rotates, but considering that when we're dealing with quantum mechanics, we can have different representations of these spatial symmetries, I'm really talking about the amount that a vector is rotated as we go around this disclination.
So is this Frank Engel quantized?
Yes, Frank Engel is quantized to be 2 pi over n for a system with n-fold rotation symmetry. And basically you can argue that if you don't have, there's no way to do this kind of invisible gluing procedure I alluded to before. If you try to basically cut out a quadrant, say if I had a C2 symmetric lattice instead of C4 symmetric lattice. If I try to do this cutting and gluing approach, I can't do the same idea of like making the cut invisible when I glue it back together. The cut will always be visible, and you can show that a little bit more precisely with how the unitaries act on these states. And you kind of think that the other way of seeing it is that the flux is basically the amount you rotate, and so if I'm rotating by amount that's not symmetric, I don't expect anything interesting associated with that amount of rotation. If I rotate by a quarter in a C2 symmetric system, that's not associated with any symmetry of the matter. I've completely redefined my system. So there's not really anything meaningful there in that sense. Any other questions? All right. So here again is a Frank Engel pi over 2 disclination. Okay, and so now let's go into the disclination charge response. So based on the fact that these are rotation symmetry flux, it's a symmetry flux, we expect that this is going to be encoded in some sort of a discrete gauge field, which I'm going to label C for now. So based on this, I can write down a field theory term which couples this discrete gauge field to my U1 gauge field. And basically, we can understand this wedge product as basically being if I put this on a simplex for my manifold, the wedge basically assigns a charge to basically the flux around a simplex of my manifold. But that's pretty abstract language. But this is how we get this. If we take a functional derivative, we find that the charge is going to be the flux of C, which is going to be our disclination, which is describing this effect here. And if we then look at basically what happens to this coefficient S, as we add additional symmetries, we find that it changes depending on what we have in our system. For example, for spinless fermions without time reversal symmetry, S is going to be a half integer or an integer. For spin 1/2 fermions without time reversal symmetry, it's going to be an integer. Spinless fermions with time reversal symmetry gives us an integer again, and then spin 1/2 fermions with time reversal symmetry gives us an even integer, and we can relate at least the last two by Cramer's doubling. So one problem with this approach to understanding the response in this language is that these gauge fields are discrete, which means that we really lose a lot of theoretical power because we can't understand perturbative analyses or linear response, adiabaticity, anything like that. And in practice, this means that we want to understand how a system responds to, say, a discrete symmetry flux. We basically have to solve the system in entirety with the flux already added to it. We can't use these perturbative arguments that are so essential to how we understand other symmetry fluxes. Like, for example, when I was talking earlier about getting the effective theories of U1 by integrating out fermions, these are all perturbative approaches. We're looking at small changes in the U1 gauge field. We can't, though, look at a small change in C. And that really limits how we can understand these things, basically putting it on a computer and solving it each and every time. You know, we can sometimes do it a little bit better, sometimes we can do some analytic calculations based on certain geometries. But really, we have to solve this each and every time in its entirety, which really limits it when we want to say add interactions. Yes?
So how should I understand this?
These quantizations? I don't think there's a really easy way to do it. There's more detailed calculations by looking at actual exact lattice models and how they work. I think there's an open question about do these change when interactions are added, which I do not have a good answer to. But unfortunately, I just do not have a good, like, easy answer to it. It's a little more involved. I haven't seen a good, simple one. At least we can understand the most simple one, like the top one, for example. That one we can understand as a consequence of the fact that the total curvature or the total number of disclinations in any system, the total angle spanned by all of them, must be a multiple of 4 pi to be a closed surface. And in that case, that means that the total charge in the system must be S over 2 pi times 4 pi. And we need an integer amount of charge in our system. And so we know from that S has to be a half integer. So we can argue that one. The other two are a little more in depth to get to, and they involve basically looking at systems where you can wannierize your system, and then you can connect the first and second one, basically looking at a mapping between time reversal symmetry broken spinless fermions and spin 1/2 fermions. There's an exact mapping you can do there to map them onto each other. But I think the first one you can understand as a consequence of the total disclination angle in all a system being a multiple of 4 pi, and the total charge in a system being an integer. The rest of them get more complicated after that.
So is a boson change?
Bosons, that would be an integer spin system. I presume it would. It really what matters is the representation of angular momentum. So if my boson has integer spin, it's going to be the equivalent to the spinless systems. And so this would basically mean that we could not have the spin 1/2 is what happens when we have the double covering of our Cn rotation. So Cn to the n power gives you -1 is how we get these spin 1/2. It's kind of the characteristic of the spin 1/2 fermions. So I presume you would have just the first and third options would be available for bosons.
Yes.
I mean, just in the sense that, I mean, this is more, I think, more of a definition I've heard that if your boson is a spin 1/2 boson, that is valuable, that is fine. I think just typically you consider that if it has spin 1/2, you typically consider it a fermion. But yes, I agree, it is. I'm using spin statistics to inform a lattice discussion, so that's not entirely precise, I agree with that. But I think that's more just the heuristic view of it. Well, what sort of angular momentum representations you can have? Because you can have spin orbit coupling, for example. So you can have a half integer representation of your rotation symmetry group is typically only assigned to fermions. And I think that that is informed by spin statistics, exactly as you said. And I think it just kind of carried over here as well. But I would assume that it would be hard to find a lattice model where, I'll get to you in a second, find a lattice model where you would have a double covering of your Cn rotation group. I haven't seen one, at least. So maybe there is one existent in a reasonable context. That would be something to be interesting to discuss, though. Yes?
Just a follow-up question. Can I completely think of it just from the fact that spinless fermions carry no representation under C, and C will have to carry a two-dimensional representation under C? And from this, I can derive this kind of
representation. No, they do still carry representation. They are an integer angular momentum representation. It is still a representation. Yes, I mean, yes, because right now, I mean, we're dealing with spatial rotation, so we're dealing with angular momentum. And I'm not assuming anything about spin orbit coupling being there or not being there. So in principle, I'm allowing for spin orbit coupling, which means that I can have angular momentum can be a half integer when it's a spin orbit coupled system, for example. Like, example, a lot of spin 1/2 churn insulators, lattice models have spin orbit coupling in them, where you find that the angular momentum representation group is a double cover of, say, Cn. I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of that question. Could you repeat it?
I think of it in terms of coordinate group.
Yeah.
The spinless fermions, spin times C6, something like that.
Yeah.
And spin 1/2, spin times C6 mod
C2. Yes, I believe that's correct. Yeah, and then also, you know, if you have, but if you don't have spin orbit coupling, you can always then kind of decouple your spin degree of freedom and effectively arrive at a spinless fermion model again if you have independent spin. So I am kind of assuming that spin orbit coupling is allowed in these systems. If we have extra symmetries, like, yeah, spin conservation, then basically everything's a spinless fermion. I can always add a additional flux of pure spin rotation symmetry to basically remove the contribution, the coupling to the spin and angular momentum, regardless of how the microscopic theory might be behaving.
So just,
please.
I'm not sure if the, like here, the spin rotation is fine with the lattice rotation.
Yeah. I'm allowing it to be, though. I'm allowing for spin orbit coupling. I mean, again, it might not necessarily be the case. Exactly as you said, it could be the case that I have a spin 1/2 system of fermions that is not spin orbit coupled. That is allowed, in which case it would effectively reduce to a spinless system of fermions. I can always basically just, you know, counteract any sort of additional spin rotation by an additional spin rotation symmetry flux on top of it. We can only basically remove any spin orbit coupling effects induced by this flux in that way. Please. Only if they're spin 1/2.
Okay, so spin 1/2 is not the Cramer's degeneracy.
Spin 1/2 does have Cramer's degeneracy.
That depends on your definition.
I'm assuming the spin 1/2 fermions have Cramer's degeneracy here, yes. Now, yeah, this is an assumption. I'm assuming that the spin 1/2 fermions always have Cramer's degeneracy. So T squared equals -1 for a Cramer's degenerate pair of fermions. Yes, no, that is, yes, you are right. I am assuming that by hand. I think it's a pretty physically motivated assumption, at least. But yes, I agree. In principle, I would have to. If I don't have Cramer's degeneracy, then S is always in Z, regardless of spin versus spin 0 versus spin 1/2. All right, any other questions? Please. Okay. Yes, no, good question, good question. What I'm talking about here is whether or not the angular momentum is integer or half integer, the total angular momentum of my system, basically the J, so L plus S. So I'm assuming that basically by spin 1/2, I really mean here is that the full angular momentum of that transformed under Cn takes on half integer values. For spin 1/2 fermions and for spinless fermions, it takes on integer values. Yes, that's a more precise way of putting it. Any more questions before I move on? All right. I think with this kind of hopefully motivated that while this tool is very powerful and can describe a lot of things, it does really limit our theoretical power to understand these discrete gauge fields. And the natural question is there, is there now an analogous response we can consider that allows us to use these perturbative methods that hopefully unlock a lot more power to understand where these responses come from and how we can consider them in different contexts? All right, so what we're going to be talking about today is basically the idea that we can use responses to fluxes of SO2 continuous rotation symmetries to model these discrete symmetry responses. And again, SO2 equals U1, so just we all know that. And then importantly, since these fluxes are now continuous, I can now imagine adiabatically adding them the same way I adiabatically add a magnetic symmetry flux. And this now allows me to use my linear response, adiabatic theorem, perturbative arguments, all my good tools in my theorist toolbox. And now importantly, how to understand this more physically is that the fluxes of SO2 are going to be points of curvature. And I will discuss this more in detail through like a very like, concrete discussion of why this is. But basically, the idea is that I'm going to take my responses of lattice fermions to defects and map that on now to a continuum theory where I can understand the responses of fermions lattice defects and turn the responses of continuum fermions to curved space. And so basically, I'm going to be saying that the basic point of this talk will be that this actually works. It's probably robust in both in analyzing known responses and predicting new responses. Please.
Mathematically, are you basically trying to lift the discrete gauge field to a continuous one?
I would say that is actually even one step more advanced than what I'm doing right now. I am going to try, and that's like the ultimate goal. I would say the holy grail of this would be to literally go mathematically in like a Higgsing melting procedure or like a spontaneous symmetry breaking, going from continuous to discrete symmetries. Right now, I'm trying to show you that this is even a good idea to begin with, that there is at least enough foundation that we can understand that the continuum responses should correspond to last responses and vice versa, and that basically the tools we would use to understand the continuum responses do work well enough, and so we can kind of understand the responses in terms of matter theories coupled to spatial curvature do inform the lattice models in a reasonable way. But it would be a good idea to do this, because I'd say a priori, with good intuition, you would know that that would work, but knowing that the responses would behave well under this combination going from a continuous to discrete gauge field, I don't think is obvious, or at least entirely on solid footing, to say the least.
Yeah. I don't know how relevant this comment is. I think about translation, symmetry gauge field, they are Z value gauge field.
Yes.
Z, and there, if I want to lift the translation gauge field to from Z to R, that lift is well defined and it's injective.
Yes.
Obstruction of that is the torsion part of H upper one, which is always vanishing. So everything is well behaved.
Yes. No, you're totally correct on that.
Here you're doing Zn and you're probably doing that.
Yeah.
So would there be some obstruction and so on?
So great question. So I think the reason why, at least in my kind of low-level way of expressing this, the reason why it's easier for translations other than rotation is that as I go with my continuum limit, my Burgers vector, which is basically the amount of translation, the amount goes to zero. And so the flux we're seeing on the lattice do go to a infinitesimal flux as we pass the continuum limit in a very literal way. And so there's less to worry about when going from these discrete fluxes on the lattice to continuum torsion fluxes in the continuum, because basically the amount of flux I'm adding is literally going to zero, so I'm taking this limit. Angles are dimensionless, so I can't do that. If I go from my my last field, my continuum theory, my defect angle is going to stay my defect angle. It's not going to go to zero. And so I lose that power of being able to make similar claims about this with, I think, less impunity, I would say. Answer all question behind you? Oh, sorry, did I say a question on you? Oh, my bad. Yeah, so this is going to be kind of the main purpose of the talk. So let's discuss, you know, now in some more detail how to go from this in a more, basically, why is curvature going to map on weld lattice defects? Is this actually a reasonable thing even to begin with on the level of the lattice? Not even considering matter yet. Let's just see on the lattice, is this reasonable to do? And, you know, spoilers, it will be. So basically, I'm going to start with my lattice and want to go to my manifold. Let's just look at 2D for the time being. So I want to keep track of orientations. So I'm looking at rotation symmetry fluxes. I'm going to need to basically know which direction things are pointing on the lattice. So I need to assign primitive lattice vectors. Now, if I open up my elasticity theory book, it turns out there's a very natural continuum object I can use to relate to these primitive lattice vectors. It's going to be my inverse frame fields. And just for some quick definitions, these frame fields are basically the square root of the matrix in this sense. We can write it in this form. And where essentially we're only looking at the spatial part, so I'm not looking at, I'm looking at a lattice, so I don't care about time-related curvature, I don't really care about spatial curvature. So basically I'm using ij indices to reflect that, not mu nu indices, as you might need for a relativistic theory. I'm only looking at spatial curvature, not space-time curvature. And then on, you know, kind of this equivalence, it's basically going to say that I should label this ei1 to the x-hat primitive vector, and this EI2 to the y-hat primitive vector on my lattices. And so I've gone from a lattice system to a vector bundler over my manifold. OK, so to make this thing a little bit easier and try to make things a little more tractable based on the time problem we're looking at, we're going to assume that away from any defects, our manifold is flat, which basically means that if we're looking at our lattice, away from the defect, it's regular. We're not looking at a fully distorted lattice. We're looking at basically point-like distortions of our lattice, and everything basically significantly far away from those defect points looks like a normal lattice. Here our manifold just looks flat away from those points. Yes? No, not yet. Not yet, at least.
So you just in some manifold, the curvature cannot always be chosen to be
your. Yeah, so I'm doing some coordinate patch over my manifold. That's why it's so locally. So I'm looking at like a coordinate patch where I can set my metric to be flat.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, agreed. Yeah, not globally, just locally. Just locally. Okay. Yes, not globally. If we tried globally flat, I'd be looking at, you know, Rn, and I think that'd be a pretty boring topic for a talk. Yeah, so, and I want to give, so if we want to do this flat manifold, a good choice of our inverse frame field is going to be this form right here. So two angles at a right angle to each other that make some sort of angle theta with some arbitrary direction on the manifold. And if I now look at this and remember that I'm supposed to be relating these inverse frame fields to my primitive lattice vectors and kind of return to this picture from before, I see as I go around, my primitive lattice vectors wind by the Frank angle. And so in this language where I'm parameterizing my inverse frame fields by theta, I'm going to see that this disclination is going to correspond to a winding of theta over this loop. And again, I really have to be talking about patches and overlap functions to do this properly, because any local patch, theta has to be single valued. So I'm really looking at the winding, you know, done over multiple coordinate patches, really how I should be thinking about this. Or, you know, maybe just with a branch cut that I have to then relate over the branch cut by a boundary condition choice. So it turns out, though, that these frame fields have actually a gauge ambiguity to them in their definition. And it comes from this kind of inverse nature. I can always take the frame field and basically rotate them. And as long as I keep them orthogonal to each other, I will not actually change the metric. There's also actually a mirror ambiguity there, too. I'm not going to talk too much about that because it's not really pertinent for this conversation. But basically, the idea is that I can always change this angle theta locally while still preserving the metric structure. And if you want to, you can think about this as arising from the fact that there really is no right or wrong choice of how to label my primitive lattice vectors up to Zn. So I could have this being my primitive lattice vectors, or I could have this being them, or this, or this. So it really doesn't matter like how I choose them. It's, you know, something I put in by hand to label my different directions. And I think that's kind of the way of viewing this ambiguity you're seeing right here. It's a kind of continuous ambiguity inherited from this discrete ambiguity. Again, this is a little bit different. I'm going from something discrete to something continuous, so don't try to think too hard about this. I would say it's more for physical intuition. So with this in mind, for this flat metric, I can now define my spin connection by, say, opening up my favorite differential geometry or GR book, and it finds that for this flat metric, the form of my spin connection simplifies a lot to really where it's just going to be the derivative between these pair of frame fields, which in terms of these theta angle and parameterizing them by, it's just going to be the angle it changes by. So basically, I can imagine the spin connection is telling me how much these inverse frame fields are rotating as I'm going along a certain direction. So, and importantly, this means that if I look at the gauge transformations of the spin connection, it's going to transform as you would expect for a gauge field. So it is, in fact, I think, reasonable to understand this as being the SO2 gauge field or the SO2 probe field. So it transforms kind of as a U1, similar to like a U1 gauge field does. And importantly, we can also now look at the gauge invariant tensor associated with the spin connection, which is going to be actually exactly the curvature tensor that defines our manifold. So then to kind of conclude that I am talking about something reasonable, we can now look at what's going to happen if I take this kind of disclination configuration where theta wind by theta f as I go around some sort of point. And if I look at the integral of the spin connection over that loop, I'm going to find that the flux of the spin connection will in fact just be the defect angle or the Frank angle of that defect. And that tells us that if we look at a lateral disclination, this seems to tell us we should map that onto a manifold with singular points of curvature. All right, any questions here before I move on? But I think the bottom part of the takeaway, there's a very literal way of moving from a manifold with disclinations, excuse me, a lattice disclinations to a manifold with singular points of curvature.
Are you going to keep the curvature singular, or do you actually want to spread it out?
I will be spreading it out for the perturbative calculations, yes. But yes, this is like the exact way of doing it. But yeah, since we now have this enlarged configuration, though, we can now look at, you know, smooth configurations, not just point-like configurations. This is like kind of the literal statement, but I really want to use the power that we now have in having a continuous gauge field to really take advantage of that. If I was only looking at point-like sources, I mean, I think I would not really gain that much by taking one language for the other. It's really, yeah, there really is really that I can smooth it out now and use it perturbatively. All right. So with that in mind, let's now look at the corresponding theory that's going to describe the disclination charge response, but now in the curvature language. So we expect that's going to be charged on the curvature, and it turns out that's already a term we know of that describes this in the effective field theory. It's what's known as the Wien-Z term, which was first discussed in the context of the quantum Hall states, basically described why if you have a quantum Hall fluid on a sphere, it's going to have less charge or more charge than a quantum Hall fluid described on a flat plane. And it basically tells you that extra charge is going to be assigned to points of curvature. So the basic idea is that if I take some sort of a cone, again, I'm going to use these point-like examples just for clarity. If I have, say, a cone, which is a single point of curvature in my manifold, I'm going to find a little bit of extra charge up there. And that should be equated with the disclination response, which tells me that if I have a lattice disclination, that's also going to bind charge. So I'm again doing this dictionary of lattice defect equals point-like source of curvature. And now we have to look at the quantization. This term, the shift, which is the S coefficient, is going to be half integer quantized. And I alluded to this before, but the basic idea of why this is to use the Gauss-Bonnet theorem to show that the total curvature of a closed surface is going to be a multiple of 4 pi. And then I also know that the total charge in the closed surface must also be an integer. So taking those two facts together, this means that I also have that S is going to be a half integer. So it's a half integer quantized property. I guess any questions about, you know, the Wien-Z term, properties of this, anything like this? Nope. All right, good. So with this in mind, we can now get on some real examples. Now let's try to use it to try to do something interesting with. And the example I'm going to choose to look at are going to be these high-order topological insulators, which, I mean, I think people have different views on them. I'm going to talk to you about them because I think there's a very easy way of showing that they have disclination responses, and that's in a very natural place to consider these sorts of phenomena. But we see disclination responses in all types of lattice systems, various Chern insulator variants, Hofstadter models, certain weak SPTs even. So this is not just only for these examples, but I think they have a nice real space character to them, which complements this way of kind of looking at these fluxes assigned to charges in real space. So if you don't know, if we have a normal topological insulator, it has something anomalous on its boundary, like a anomalous amount of charge, or a chiral mode, or a single Dirac fermion. And we go down to the second order, which is where we're going to be living, in particular this quadrupole model, we find that the boundary of our boundary, so the corners or the hinges of our system, are going to have something anomalous. Here, a half integer charge for the d equals 2 second order. or a chiral mode for the third order, which I won't be talking about. And again, you can do third order, which is going to then be the vertices of your cube and so on and so forth. It's the whole, you know, way you can stretch this down. But again, I'm really going to be focused most on the fact that these systems have a very easy real space way of understanding disclination charge associated with them. So just to kind of set the stage and give you guys a lattice model to think about, I like lattice models, so I always want to see a lattice model early on in the talk. Maybe the model we're going to consider is going to be known as the quadrupole insulator or the Banalkazar-Bernabeu-Hughes model after its creators. It is the first example of a two-dimensional high-order topological phase. It's a model of spinless fermions with time-reversal symmetry, C4 symmetric. It has half-integer charges at its corners, as shown in this kind of little plot right here. If you look at real space and solve this model, there are these little peaks and deficits. And the fact that these occur at the corners kind of gives it a quadrupole moment. And importantly, as I'm going to show you in the next slide, this thing always has half-integer charges at pi over 2 disclinations. Now, with that in mind, let's ask the question, is there a theory of thermions in curved space that we can use to understand this disclination response in the system, and does it net us any kind of new understanding of this system? And as we kind of guessed based on the previous section, the response we're going to find is going to be this quadrupole insulator, this Wnz term, excuse me, with a s equals 2 out front, would give you the correct that the pi over 2 sources of curvature will bind half an integer of charge. I guess any questions before I move on from this about basic details about this model? Yes?
So here, the traffic on the disclination is quantized. So is it protected by C4?
Yes, it's protected by a combination of C4 and U1.
So my question is, if I introduce some on-site potential to bring C4 to C2,
yes.
Would you still expect traffic to be quantized on this combination?
If that was the case, you would find quantized charges only on pi disclinations. So that's basically the disclination that's a flux of C2 symmetry. However, in that case, since you've broken C4 symmetry, you no longer expect there to be anything interesting associated with fluxes of C4 symmetry. You don't typically expect there to be something interesting associated with a symmetry flux of something that's not a symmetry of your system. All right, so now how to teach your child about disclination responses in higher-order topological phases. So we're going to start off with our quadrupole insulator. We have a half integer of charge at each corner, and then we're going to cut it into quadrants. We're going to use this cut and glue approach from earlier. Let's zoom in. Since we now know that each of these corners is going to have a half integer of charge, we're going to find that when we kind of cut these things apart, we're going to find four little quadrants, each with half an integer of charge in this oscillating pattern here. We're then going to remove one of those quadrants, like this, and then we're going to glue it back together. And sure enough, once we remove one of those quadrants, we see that the net charge left over is now a half integer of charge. And then we can see, without doing anything special or fancy, we can now see very easily that this system with corner charges will naturally have a disclination response. And that's, you know, I think one of the reasons I like these systems to consider for these geometric responses, that we can understand this very much in real space without having to do anything too fancy. All right. Yes, please. I believe so, yes. At least the classification I know of for it is Z2 classified. Yes, it is Z2 classified. Yeah, because basically the way of seeing that is that you can relate these classifications to the amount of charge at the corner, and if I stack two of these things on top of each other, there's always going to be an integer amount of charge at the corner, and the integer amount of charge can always be added or removed via local perturbation, so it's not a topological quantity. Please.
Is there a phase where on this disclination have one quarter charge?
That is a different model, but yes, there is a model that does do that. This also has particle hole symmetry. If I don't have particle hole symmetry, then it is Z4 classified. This is the two classification of this, but yes, if I only have just C4 and U1, it is Z4. Yeah, sorry, I misanswered your question. If I have particle hole, it becomes Z2. And basically, the particle hole guarantees it's also going to be gapless, zero-energy modes at the corners as well. Although we're not really going to be talking too much of those. So yes, it should be Z4 for just U1 and C4. Thank you. All right. Everyone's good with arts and crafts time being over now. We can move on. So basically, here's our lattice model. Just kind of flash a few details. This is the lattice model. It consists of intersite and intra-site hoppings. And basically, when we have these gamma and lambda terms being equal to each other, it has C4 symmetry. I'm going to flash this pretty fast, so it's not going to matter too much. I just want to motivate there actually is a real model to realize this physics. And this has two phases, a trivial phase and a quadruple phase. And they intersect each other when the hopping within a unit cell and hopping between neighbor unit cells is equal to each other. And now the most important part of this slide is really that this critical point, this black dot between the trivial and topological phases, we're going to find that we're going to have a Dirac-like band crossing. And this is also going to be basically a double, so it's going to be a four-band crossing, unlike the normal two-band crossings of normal Dirac fermion systems. In 2D, this is going to be a four-band Dirac crossing. So it has basically spin and isospin, if you want to think about it that way, at low energies.
In terms of number of flavors of two-component Dirac fermions, how many flavors?
Two-component flavors. Yeah, so four bands, two-component flavors. All right. So based on this, we can now think of a continuum theory that's going to basically realize this physics. Yes? Yes, they do. They're degenerate with each other. I mean, it depends on your basis. There's a mass term, so in one basis they don't couple, in one basis they do couple. And this is the critical theory between two gap phases. Yeah. So we're at a critical point here. Yeah, so the mass term may couple them or not couple them, depending on which basis you're in. I'm going to choose the basis where they don't couple. But yeah, it depends on, you know, non-important details. Yes, it's just a completely free fermion theory. It's almost like if you take this kind of dimerized SSH chain, it's the 2D analog of that in a certain sense. Right now, it doesn't even matter. I'm just motivating this next continuum model. There is a more literal way of going between these two, there is a correct basis, where basically you can look at it, since it has turn number 0, you can actually choose a basis, which looks like turn number 1, turn number minus 1 bilayer is a basis for it, but it's not going to be too important for this.
Sorry.
Please.
So two flavor of two component Dirac fermion.
Yes, two flavor, two component Dirac fermions. Maybe next slide I think might have helped this out. So our theory is going to be two flavors of two component Dirac fermions. So we have our poly matrices that are going to be our spin matrices, and we also have our isospin matrices, tau. Here it is. And then for incurved space, we include our inverse frame field, which coupled to our derivatives. And then we also have to include our spin connection in our covariant derivative, which couples via this combination of poly matrices and tau matrices. So I think the two ingredients that led to this being the correct model are, one, it has the correct number of flavor and the correct dispersion at the critical point, and also it has the correct gaps dispersion at low energies as well. And additionally, we find that the angular momentum of these fermions, if we look at the SO2 angular momentum of these states, we're going to find that they have the same angular momentum as the C4 angular momentum at the high symmetry point, mod 4. So this seems like a reasonable place to start. The angular momentum representations are compatible with each other if I go from the last to the continuum. And again, since it's a theory of curved space, I have an SO2 gauge symmetry shown here. I'm going to use my definition from before in terms of the frame field, in terms of theta, as well as the spin connection. And then the SO2 gauge transformation is exactly the same one we saw before. It's a rotation that depends on space and time of these frame fields. In addition to rotating the frame field and the spin connection, it's also going to transform the fermions as well, which will basically pick up this phase, which if you notice, the thing that's being multiplied by phi is actually the angular momentum of the fermions in terms of the SO2 angular momentum. So this unitary operation I'm acting on the fermions by can be really be thought of as a gauged version of the SO2 transformation. Or sorry, a local version of the SO2 transformation more exactly. All right, I guess any questions about this model or any details about it? Here the curvature is really coming about from a combination of the spin connection and the frame fields. All right, good. So now our plan of attack for understanding this theory, we are going to start with the continuum theory. We're going to couple the fermions to omega and A. Then we're going to integrate them out to find our effective action. This is going to be the form of it. We are then going to find that upon integrating them out, we sure enough find there is a win z term in the effective action. It is, again, a one-loop calculation. We're going to use the fact that the win z term is quantized to know we don't have to go above one loop. And sure enough, we find it in this massive phase, which is our quadrupole insulating phase. we are sure enough going to find that S equals 2, as we expected, based on the response of the quadrupole insulator and how much charge we expect at a pi over 2 source of curvature. All right, so this seems good. What can we learn about that's new? Well, the first thing we can look at is the boundary anomaly associated with this system. So if we have a system with boundary, this Wynn-Z term is actually not invariant under U1 gauge transformations, and actually it gets shifted by a total derivative as shown here. How we can interpret this is that if we look at the boundary of our system, this means there's going to be a non-conservation of charge at the boundary of our system when we have a gauge SO2 symmetry. And this is kind of a very similar story to the chiral anomaly at the surface of a quantum Hall insulator. This is kind of the mutual Chern-Simons equivalent of the chiral anomaly, if you will. And it's a mixed anomaly, or some call it a Hooft anomaly in this context. So it's a 1D system with non-conserved charge when I have gauged SO2 symmetry. And if I integrate the system, I find that the non-conserved amount of charge during a process where I add curvature is going to be equal to this term. It's going to be 1/2 the number of pi over 2 disclination sources in my system. So how do I understand this? Well, it turns out I can understand this very easily by looking at my lattice model again. So if I go to my lattice model, I find that if I have no disclinations, my model is going to have 4 corners. And so if I look at the total charge, it's always going to be an integer because each corner contributes a half integer of charge. However, if I add 1 disclination to my system, which I'm going to map onto a pi over 2 source of curvature, I find now I have 5 corners. And since each corner carries a half integer of charge, I now have an extra half integer of charge at the boundary of my system. And this is actually very similar to what's happening. I'm adding extra curvature to my system or extra defects to the center of my system, and I'm getting extra charge on the boundary of my system. And so it seems like even though I'm starting with a continuum theory with no knowledge of a boundary or corner modes or anything like that, I'm still arriving at a theory that seems to somehow know about corner charges in a very universal way. Which is a hint that if we're looking at these quadrupole insulators, we're really looking at just a manifestation of some sort of intrinsic response to defects in the bulk is really the manifestation of these corner charges. All right, I think that takes me about to the end of my discussion of the quadrupole insulator in 2D. Any questions here? All right, good. So finally, we're going to now look at 3 dimensions. And we're going to ask now if we can use, since we can use these curvature responses to capture the essential features of known responses, can we now use them to predict new responses that have not been found elsewhere? And I'm going to show that is the case, and we actually can find a nice 3D example of this. So we know in 2D that SO2 fluxes bind charge. Now let's look at 3 dimensions. So we're going to start off simple, because if we look at the full rotation group of a 3-dimensional system, that's a non-abelian group, we want to start easy, so we're going to just look at one plane of rotation. We're going to look at basically rotation of the XY plane, which is an abelian group. That simplified law of analysis. And basically, this is equivalent to only considering the curvature of the XY planes. The Z planes in the T direction have no curvature associated with them. All the curvatures in the XY plane, that's really just a simplifying assumption. There's no, nothing special, just making this problem easier. And now the response we could have with this is that these fluxes, which are going to be line-like in 3 dimensions, could have a quantized polarization. And it means if I have this kind of flux-line configuration here, I will find that where the line terminates, I'm going to have charges. And equivalently, what this should map onto, using our intuition from before, is some sort of 3-dimensional insulator that when I add a disclination line to it, which is going to be a manifestation of this SO2 flux line, I'm going to find at the surface of this system, it's going to have charges. All right. So what sort of field theory will describe this sort of response in the continuum limit? So we're going to start off with an SO2 gauge field. We're going to define omega, basically the same thing as before, just now in 3 dimensions instead of 2 dimensions. And we're going to now find that the gauge strength of this term is going to be the XY plane curvature. Based on this, I can now write down the following gauge invariant topological term, which I'm going to call the R wedge F term. And it's going to couple the curvature R to the field strength F. And this term is going to describe this disclination, or sorry, SO2 line polarization argument that I'm going to show right now. So we have a flux line, which is this configuration of R, and I put that into my R wedge F term, I'm going to find the resulting action takes on this one-dimensional form. And this 1D form is actually exactly the action for a one-dimensional object with a total polarization of phi over 2 pi. So this R wedge F term really is describing the response where a flux line is becoming a polarized object. Okay, so let's now look at a fermionic theory for it. We're going to choose a theory of two non-relativistic 3D direct fermions. They're going to be in curved space. We're also going to include a coupling to a non-dynamic scalar boson phi, which is going to play the role of the coefficient of this R wedge F term. Here's our theory. It looks pretty similar to the theory we saw before. The main difference is that now we have this mass term that depends on the scalar field phi. But yes, now this is two three-dimensional direct fermions, so it's eight bands total, two four-component fermions. And we're going to play the same game as before, you know, integrate out the fermions. And sure enough, we find that once we do that, we find that our effective action in terms of A, omega, and this new scalar phi is going to be exactly the R wedge F term I discussed previously. So this does seem to be, it is probably at least a way of realizing this in a model, but now we have to figure out what it means on the lattice and how we can realize it in actuality. All right. So it turns out to get some intuition of what's going on here. We're going to compare this R wedge F term to the three-dimensional theta term, because they have a lot of similar properties. So let's go over the 3D theta term first. It's a total derivative. This coefficient out front is periodic. And domain walls of this theta are going to bind unquantized Chern-Simons term. And so if I have some sort of domain wall configuration like this, I'm going to find that at the domain wall, I'm going to have some sort of Chern-Simons term. But unlike the normal Chern-Simons term that has an integer coefficient, this can have any coefficient, because basically the other anomaly data being canceled out by some other domain wall somewhere else in space is how you can think about that. And finally, we have the Witten effect, where monopoles of A carry charge. Let's look at the R wedge F term, which should look pretty similar. We've literally just taken an R and then replaced it with an F. So should be pretty similar. Again, total derivative. Again, the coefficient is periodic. Here, though, we're going to have that domain walls of phi are going to bind Chern-Simons term, which are also going to be unquantized. And again, same logic. We have some sort of jump in phi, say, along the z direction. And we're going to find that at this jump, we're going to find that the two-dimensional system with some sort of unquantized Chern-Simons term. And again, the gauge invariance is restored by having multiple domain walls in our system. And this is now going to have a mixed Witten effect. We're going to find that monopole configurations of omega are now going to bind electric charge. And similarly, in the reverse, we're going to find that we have electric monopoles, so monopoles of A, they're going to have SO2 charge or angular momentum. All right. We're getting close to the end. Now, this is actually going to predict a new type of topological crystalline insulator, much in the same way that the 3D theta term corresponds to three-dimensional topological insulators. And the basic idea is that for spinless fermions with time virtual symmetry, phi is going to be 2 pi periodic. And this odd term is also odd under either particle hole symmetry or mirror symmetry, which means that for a symmetric insulator, we're going to have either 0 or pi. Yes. Oh, sorry, never mind then. Yeah, so that means we're going to have only 2 possible values for a symmetric insulator, 0 or pi. And again, if we have other symmetries or other representations, this might change, but yes. Let's see, I think right now we're just looking at how it transforms the gauge field. So that isn't even actually even a part. We're just looking at how the gauge fields transform under this particle hole symmetry. It's anti-unitary. Sorry, miss. Yes, it's anti-unitary particle hole symmetry. Anti-unitary in a many-body basis.
And it flips charge.
Yeah, so basically, we're looking at we're treating the particle hole symmetry as a symmetry that takes AMU to minus AMU, but leaves omega invariant. So it flips all our charges, but leaves lattice the same.
AMU goes to minus AMU for all components of mu?
All components of mu.
That's unitary.
Yeah. That is unitary?
Let's say if you take time reversal, then either AG goes to minus AD and all the
AD. Yes.
Or the other way around.
Okay.
Everything.
Well, so I believe the fermionic theory is an anti-unitary. The fermionic theory that realizes this, I'm going to discuss later, has an anti-unitary particle hole symmetry. So maybe I'm getting them mixed up. But it is anti-unitary in this mini body basis, like in terms of the fermionic theory.
I mean, maybe we'll have a
channel. Yeah. Yeah. I think I might miss some subtleties there. And so this non-trivial value of phi should correspond to some new class of insulator, which either particle hole symmetry or mirror symmetry along the z direction. So let's try to figure out what this new phase of matter is going to do. So we know, first of all, that domain walls between these two configurations are going to correspond to some sort of wind z term with a half integer coefficient. Now, this means that if we have gap surfaces of this topological insulator, which can be viewed as a domain wall between the trivial and non-trivial phases, this should have the corresponding disclination response with this little s coefficient being 1/2. We're going to use the intuition from basically what we discussed in the second part of this talk. Which means that if I have this surface theory, it's going to be this surface theory right here. And if I add a pi over 2 disclination to the surface, it's going to bind charge 1 over 8. Here, this mod 1 I'm talking about is going to come from purely 2D surface effects. Basically, I can always add a layer that will shift the coefficient of this s by 1. And more importantly, this f is actually half the amount can occur in two-dimensional systems with time reversal symmetry. So this is like half the amount of something, which should sound very familiar to the half Hall conductance you find the surface of a three-dimensional topological insulator. We're again seeing some sort of three-dimensional phase that has half of something at its surface. And in general, this gap surface is going to break particle hole symmetry. But via mirror symmetry, I can actually preserve it because mirror symmetry will, in general, exchange surfaces. And so I can basically find certain configurations of domain walls that will actually preserve mirror symmetry. But particle hole symmetry as an on-site symmetry will always be broken by these domain walls. All right, so now look at a lattice model. Basically, the last model we're going to use is a doubled strong TI. This is motivated by the fact that a normal strong TI critical theory is a single Dirac fermion. Here, we're going to look, since we want two four-component Dirac fermions, we're going to look at a doubled strong TI. And we're also going to impose a particle hole symmetry on this. So it turns out there's going to be 5 gapped phases. We can already infer that 2 of them are going to be trivial insulators because they're basically adiabatically connected to some limit where we're taking this free parameter m off to infinity. And this is, say, a sample band structure inside of those different gapped regions. All right. Now to conclude, we want to basically now confirm we're actually going to see this response I've talked so much about. We should be seeing that there is some, you know, fractional charge at these gap domain walls. And I want to make sure that I'm not just, you know, this entire talk isn't for nothing. So I'm going to take my theory. I'm going to put on my disclinated lattice. And sure enough, if I look at certain values of m, I find there's going to be a polarization of my charge. And this charge is going to be localized around my disclination core. And so if I look at this system, we see that there's motor charge, there's positive charge on one boundary, negative charge on the other boundary. We have a polarization. The charge is localized around this disclination core. We do, in fact, have these polarized disclinations. I claim we would, based on this effective field theory. We can all then now look at how this value of charge at the boundary changes as a function of this m parameter from my lattice model in the previous slide. And I see that for m between -3 and -1 and 1 and 3, the charge is going to be -1/8, which is the topologically non-trivial amount of charge. However, between -1 and 1, well, the charge is non-zero. It's actually a trivial amount of charge because it's 1/4, which can be realized by a purely two-dimensional system. And so I can imagine I can screen that extra 1/4 of charge, basically adding a 2D layer to my system. So really, we see that now, if we look at this, we now see there's two RTCI phases to this model, which have this non-trivial half of a disclination response on its surface. This is pretty good. So I think we've now seen that we can do some cool stuff with these curvature responses to understand crystalline phases. However, as you might have noticed, I am missing something. We currently understand how to do responses to lattice defects by doing numerics. We also can understand responses to spatial curvature and field theory. We need to connect them now somehow. And most likely it's going to involve some sort of a spontaneous symmetry breaking of a topological fluid. So basically, what happens in a topological fluid when I break down my continuous rotation symmetry down to a discrete subgroup? Or alternatively, in reverse, if I have a topological crystal, what happens when I melt it by proliferating defects? I think these are two open questions I'd really like to know more about. If anyone has any thoughts about them, I'd love to hear them. And I think is, you know, understanding how this occurs and kind of the more general also how these continuous symmetries go to discrete symmetries and vice versa between fluids and crystals for topological phases and how it affects their responses is a very interesting question to me, which will really be needed to round out this story and really be shown that we can actually trust these results in their entirety. Okay, so this takes me into my talk. Just kind of list a few future directions. I think another place we can try to use this logic is for strongly correlated systems. Obviously, basically, you know, putting it on a lattice is kind of hard to do once you have strong interactions. However, these continuum approaches, we have more tools at our disposal to use, dualities, things like that. So we might be able to find new ways of understanding strongly correlated systems and geometric responses. This could be very interesting for, say, magic angle graphene, which has a very, you know, kind of big lattice structure which can be manipulated in a certain sense by hand. And so there might be some interesting ways of using these disclination responses to actually predict properties of magic angle graphene that could be, say, detected by local probes. Additionally, there's been some ongoing work about how we can realize these geometric responses in real materials and how they connect to, say, Dirac semi-metals and other rotation symmetry protected phases in three dimensions. And finally, another thing I'm curious about is how we can add, in generality, translation symmetry fluxes. This maybe corresponds to adding torsion, as Chong said earlier. And this makes it a bit more complicated, though, because now our rotations and translations don't commute with each other. We would now take that into account. So that's an extra level of difficulty, even in the basic levels of understanding these theories. But I still think it's a very interesting problem, and there are, you know, a lot of subtleties involving how we construct disclinations on a lattice. For example, if we have a disclination centered around a site or a plaquette, these differ by a translation symmetry flux or a dislocation. And so it'd be nice to understand how that works in the continuum limit. With that, thank you very much, and let's open up to questions. Yes, please. It is like the real, honest to God curvature of the manifold. I am.
This looks manifested like a mixed gravitational
one. I agree it looks like that. Yes, I agree it looks like that. I am not feel comfortable if I can actually say that in entirety. I feel like the people who know gravity better than I do might have objections to me saying that. It definitely has that flavor for sure. Yeah, so I think, yeah, talking about, you know, Dominic's paper. I think that's a very interesting way. This was definitely very influential. His, like, kind of perspective on these questions were very influential in how I thought about a lot of machinery. I would say the problem with that kind of crystalline equivalence principle is that you lose the spatial flavor of these responses, which maybe, you know, I'm hoping to talk to him tomorrow about this. Maybe he can reveal why that's incorrect or something that I'm missing. But my impression that you kind of lose the how that basically impacts the spatial degrees of freedom here. And again, I'm only looking at a subset of curvature here for three dimensions. I'm only looking at one curvature plane, which is a subset of the full SO3 symmetry of curved space or the full Lorentz group of space-time. I'm looking at a very like specific, non-physical, anisotropic type of curvature in these systems. We're not looking at real gravity here. This is not real gravity. This is some weird space-time I thought up in my head. The gauge group is different.
The gauge group line is like one just has hands for one symmetry. Is that what you're
doing? No, one is not abelian. Let's use spatial curvature only. Spatial curvature is SO3. That's not abelian. It is a restriction, but that restriction changes the structure of the group a lot. So it has that character, but I feel like it's an overreach trying to directly equate them. Maybe I'm being too conservative on this matter. Maybe there is something more we can say about it, but the fact that it's abelian to non-abelian feels like a very big jump to me. I would not feel that you should be directly trying to equate these things. This is more of a proof of concept. You can't really couple an SO3 gauge group directly to a U1 gauge group in this way. You have indices left over. If you tried to say do this, where is it? You need to contract something with the SO3 index. Yeah, so here on this right-hand side, if we had omega, or let's try to do the actual term in terms of omega. So we had the, so we had this theory. The omega would have an SO3 index in it, which I'm suppressing. Since I'm only looking at the U1 subgroup, I don't have to look at this SO3 index, but I would have to contract that with something in this theory. We can kind of imagine this is a theory when I take a vector that breaks SO3 symmetry and contracting that with that index. Here would be like some sort of vector oriented along the z direction. I'd be coupling that to the SO3 index of omega. But like if I did like full rotational space, I need to put that index somewhere. So I need basically an SO3 gauge group which isn't charged anymore. So it changes a lot if you try to add an SO3.
Can I structure such as tangent bundle factorizes as there's an associated.
Yes. Yes, I would agree with that. Maybe there's, you know, maybe there's some other way of viewing it in a more advanced way where you could do this on a more precise footing. But to me, at least, I can't see how you would get rid of the SO3 index without making your space directly anisotropic. So you have to basically induce anisotropies, which would break your SO3 gauge group explicitly.
There, at the level of the Dirac equation, am I correct to say that there's no difference between treating omega as ordinary U1 gauge field versus it's actually coming from a curved two manifold?
Yes, I think so. I agree with that. At least in these examples, which, I mean, these are kind of handpicked to be nice to work with. So at least for these examples, though, you're entirely correct. It literally, you could sample. Instead of doing curved space-time, you could look at just, you know, U1, treat omega as a U1, forget about your manifold, and you get the same response theory. The reason I'm trying to include this spatial curvature that does open up windows was to do more advanced things, like including torsion, for example. I think kind of building in this, showing that this language can be built in to be more advanced is useful. But yeah, for the responses I'm looking at, you don't need anything special. You could just say it's a U1 gauge field that use dominant crystalline equivalence principle and kind of be done with it. That's something I want to do. I think it's a lot harder of a question. I've taught some people who know kind of gravity theories and these contexts a bit better, and they've all told me it's a very hard question about how you have to even define torsion properly in these situations even as hard, and how you couple it to matter. So I've been a little wary about trying to rush in and make big claims about it, but it is a question I think is very interesting, and I would love to know more about it because it does have some direct manifestation for how we understand crystals too, at least if this equivalence I'm proposing does hold. It's a dislocation, a translation symmetry flux. Let me quickly get to my last slide. So it's a little bit it's a little bit hard to do generically both of them, but let's say we just have torsion, no curvature. Let's say we have torsion, no curvature. In this case, torsion basically is the flux of our frame field. In which case, the frame field now couples to momentum in a Dirac equation, for example. So we can treat it as a translation symmetry flux. Anton had a very beautiful talk about it yesterday. That was yesterday, right? Yeah. He had a very good talk about that. You can refer to him for more details. But basically, it's a translation symmetry flux in the continuum, and then a dislocation, this configuration, the translation symmetry flux on the lattice, which we can see because basically if we want to get, you know, in round point, normally go down once, over, up, over. We want to get around this thing, we have to go down. If we go down, over, up, over, we're now displaced by a bit from our initial point. So we've basically been translated when we try to move around this thing.
Can I understand, I redefine my lattice symmetry by combining it with an additional Lorentz transformation in the theory?
I don't think I'm following. If I'm on the lattice, I don't have Lorentz symmetry. I think maybe I'm just missing the question.
Sorry, probably. Since somehow you have spin connection and you go to the continuum,
yes.
It seems that you assume that in the continuum you have some Lorentz symmetry.
So actually, I don't have Lorentz symmetry. I only have spatial rotation symmetry. If I had full Lorentz symmetry, I'd actually have to have extra indices on my spin connection. Since I'm only dealing with spatial curvature, it's only SO2. If I have to do the two-dimensional Lorentz group, if I want to do full curvature, and that would actually require an extra index. Here I'm doing a lattice system, so I'm only looking at spatial curvature, which is SO2. If I have to do SO1, 2, if I want to do Lorentz symmetry, which has a different gauge group. Oh, sorry, do you still have questions, or?
Okay, I have that.
Yeah. Or even like, maybe like Euclidean space, for example, if I want to do Euclidean space, let's even say it's simplified matter. If we want to do Euclidean space, I would have to do then SO3 if I want to do space and time rotations. I'm here, I'm just doing space rotations because I'm on the lattice, so I'm assuming time is fixed and immutable. So that's a simplifying assumption based on the lattice theory. Yes?
A probably related question. So you see as like internal C6 rotation, not a lattice C6 rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Is the story different? How is the story different?
At this level, it's really not that different, actually. At this level, you could really just view these things all being internal symmetries and to resort to the crystalline equivalence principle, argue that there should be some sort of enlarged symmetry, which will then be Higgs down to my discrete symmetry group, and then basically get almost all these results exactly. However, I think that assumption, though, of going from the equivalence there is not, at least for me, is not physical enough. It's definitely real on a very mathematical level, obviously. But, and maybe, you know, again, I'm talking to Dominic tomorrow, maybe he can tell me why I'm wrong about this, or actually is some physical way of doing this. But as I understood it, it's more of a heuristic argument for understanding responses and things like that, and actually a direct, like, I can map this theory directly onto this theory using these things. And I think I tried to show you at least, and hopefully convince you a little bit, for at least this continuum case for spatial curvature and spatial discrete rotation, there is at least some sort of pathway you can chart out to go from a microscopic model to a continuum model by matching your angular momentum representations and, say, the number of Dirac fermions you have at your critical point. Again, there needs to be more there. I totally agree that this is not an end of a story there, but there at least are, you know, hopping points from going from my microscopic lattice theory to my theory in continuous space with curvature. I'm not sure how to do that if I were to start with a, you know, crystalline gauge principle and try to find a theory with two, say, U1 symmetries. I'm not sure of how I would actually go there directly with basically mapping on my disclinations to some flux of the U1 symmetry and how that would work and how would representations of my matter field would work there. Sorry, just one more time, it's the beginning of that. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, because you have these double covers and stuff. Yeah.
I think I have another question.
Please.
I think you mentioned it, but I missed it. So in the slide of the reasoning, you said what's missing is how to directly understand. What's next?
Yes.
So you said you can understand the response to lattice defects through geomatics.
Yes.
To spatial curvature through acuity. And what's missing is some kind of analytic understanding of response to lattice defects.
I was more arguing that there should be some more formal way of going from, say, a lattice model to a continuum model that I can really trace down how this how the responses evolve over the course of some sort of process, some sort of phase transition. So right now I have, you know, lattice theory on one side and a continuum theory on the other side. So like those are kinds of my two theories. I'm not even going to talk about how I solve them. They're just two theories. I have Hamiltonian, Lagrangian, let's say. I want to maybe find there's some way of understanding through a dynamic process or even fine tuning by hand, maybe even, a way of actually going between these two things that I can actually can see the discrete response of lattice disclinations evolving into continuous response. Or in reverse, if I can see that the continuous responses to curvature evolving into these disclination discrete responses. So I more meant the solvability just for like how we kind of treat these in practice. But yeah. Hey, I'd be interested in that. I thought about it a little bit. There are some like more literal ways of making these connections, but you kind of come to the cost of the gaugeness of the field kind of gets lost along the way. I can basically do that to you much more literally if I throw out anything about omega being a gauge field and it's treated as some sort of a background field that's encoding my lattice defects. And just forget anything about gauge theory, which might be hard to do in this present audience, but let's just, you know, pretend for a second we're all, I don't know, freshmen in undergrad and don't know anything about gauge theory. I can, there is like a literal way of basically encoding the disclination curvature in the continuum limit such a way you get the same response theory. But the gaugeness is kind of gone along those steps. I basically have to gauge fix at the very first step to go anywhere with that, which makes a lot of the other arguments I'm making about, you know, invariance, responses, how we treat these things, a lot more murky. This is the more I would say, the gauge symmetry is solid on both sides here. We have the local transformations are good things on both sides in a certain sense, but the equivalent between them now is lacking. So you basically have to lose the gaugeness and get the good mapping, or lose the mapping and get the good gaugeness. So they're kind of the two sides to it, in my opinion. Yes. So for me personally, yes.
So if you have a bosonic system,
yes.
I ask about similar questions about this high-order topological instrumentation.
Yeah. So in that case, you'd have to figure out what the critical theory. I imagine you have to look at the critical theory. So close to the point where these long wavelength fluctuations dominate is probably the most valid place to do this mapping. I would presume you could find some sort of, basically boson with some sort of, potential when the boson condenses. You'll get this, whimsy term, similar to how you do the kind of bosonic constructions of quantum Hall states. It might be a very similar story there, although I have not tested that out myself, and I don't really know how to map from the lattice either. I haven't thought too much about the boson case. It's a very interesting question, though.
I thought those might be quite complicated because the boson critical theory is complicated.
Yes. Do you mean on the continuum level, or this kind of response I'm talking about on the lattice?
I'm already assuming the continuum description.
Okay, yes. I don't see why not. I have to think about it a little bit more. I think you'd have to do similar to this. You're familiar with this paper of Ashwin Vishwanath and Sentel, I want to say, about these 3D bosonic topological insulators. I think it'd be very similar to that. You'd probably be a little careful about how you couple everything correctly, but I presume it's going to be a very similar story there. You basically have to look at some sort of a loop model, and you look at different phases of this loop model. That's my guess, at least, is what it would look like. You can probably do off like some more advanced techniques. I think there might be a network model way of doing this as well, depending on, I'm trying to think like what they did in their paper. They also look at kind of like mutual, these mutual terms that are like D one gauge field, D a second gauge field. So I presume whatever method they use is probably applicable here in some form. And if it was using the crystalline equivalence principle, you can probably do that directly, but I believe there's something along those lines you can do to understand these theories. You also just do one more answer to that. You also can just do auxiliary gauge fields too, and couple your auxiliary gauge fields to your spin connection and to your U1 charge, and integrate those out very easily. That kind of gives you like the almost stupidly easy way of getting it. You would just couple things to auxiliary gauge fields. Those auxiliary gauge fields are now your dynamic variables. Integrate them out to get this term. That's pretty straightforward, but I would say almost so easy it's not insightful anymore.
All right. Thank you again.
Thank you.